stopping you from becoming a Catholic?
Why can't women become priests?
1-833-288-EWTN.
I don't understand why I have to earn salvation.
1-833-288-3986.
What's stopping you?
Why do I need to confess my sins to a priest?
What's stopping you? This is Call to Communion with Dr. David Anders on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
What is stopping you from becoming a Catholic? We would like to talk about that with you today. This is our program geared primarily towards our non-Catholic brothers and sisters. But if you are maybe in conversation with a non-Catholic, or if you just have a general question about the faith that you're unsure of, we would be happy to talk to you as well. To be on the program, the number is 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. If you're outside the United States and Canada, your number is 1-205-271-2985, and we'll even put you straight to the front of the line at 1-205-271-2985. And you can always send us an email. The email address is openline@ewtn.com. I'm Jack Williams, Pedro Quiles producing the program. Your call screener is Matt Gubensky, and somebody is on social media watching those things, but I'll find out who that is later, and we'll move that, pass that information on to you. But if you are watching us on YouTube, we would love for you to give us a like and subscribe to the channel. That'll help us get the message out to the most number of people. And also, you can now text your question again to Dr. Anders. Just text your first name, how you're listening, and your brief question to our to our main call-in number. That's 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. So, Rich Jesse is handling our social media efforts today. Great. So, Pedro was adamantly standing by his Ace McKay. But Ace is not here today.
Okay.
And so that's why I wouldn't go down that road. And Pedro just compounded his error by having Rich get involved here. And now we're, that's why I'm laughing. So I'm Jack Williams sitting in today for Tom Price. And our host to see is every day, Dr. David Anders. How are you?
Hey, Jack. Not as happy as you are.
Nothing like live radio. Nothing like it. I've got an email here from Eddie, and he says, the Gospels tell us that at the resurrection, people will neither marry nor be given in marriage. They will be like the angels in heaven. Can this only be saying that if you die single, that's how you stay in the next life, and that women will not be forced to marry like in Jesus' time? Why is this used to justify some sort of heavenly divorce? Some husbands may be looking forward to that. Isn't it more plausible that two become one, and that what God has joined together to let no one separate means that God will join couples in some special way in the next life only known to him? Doesn't this seem more like the great mystery that Paul was referring to, Jesus and his bride? Your thoughts, please.
Yeah, thanks. Well, you know, my thoughts on this really are very little account because we have divine revelation about this. So we're, as Catholics, we're just going with what Jesus says, basically. And there's one part of your question I think is misinformed, or maybe it's not totally misinformed, but we should add a few refinements. You said, you know, something about women being forced to marry in the next life, unlike how it was in Jesus' day. Well, you know, women could be compelled to marry in Jesus' day. However, it has been an integral part of Catholicism from the beginning because of this teaching that women should not be forced to marry against their will. And one of the most radical things socially that Christianity advanced in the ancient world was precisely the thesis that women had full autonomy over the decision of how to dispose of their bodies, whether in marriage or in union to Christ. And so in the Catholic Church, we venerate in the canon of the Mass those women that are called the virgin martyrs of Christian antiquity, second and third century women who were pledged to be married to Roman men, often pagan men, who said, you know, I don't think I'm going to do that. I think I'm going to give my virginity to Christ and not to this guy over here. And they died for it, and they were willing to go to death. And that was one of the reasons why ancient pagans thought that Christians were not pro-life. Let me say that again. Ancient pagans thought that Christians were not pro-life because in the ancient Roman world, you know, women often died before the age of 30, and they generally had to have about 5 children just to maintain the level of population because infant mortality was so high. And you pretty much needed every available female to begin procreating from puberty. And here comes Christianity saying, no, you don't have to do that. And the pagans thought, well, you're going to destroy the population. What do you mean you don't have to do that? And they said, no, you don't have to do that. And eventually it became a matter of canon law that a woman who's forced to marry against her will is invalidly married. And so, honestly, Catholics were the first feminists and on this issue, they were the first feminists. So you're not wrong about the dynamics of force, but understand that it was Christianity because of this teaching that undercut those and forever changed the course of women's lives in the Western world and all of the world, well, most all of the world. So what Christ says is that we do, in fact, marry in this life, but marriage is precisely for having babies. And in the next life, there won't be marrying or giving in marriage, and we'll be like the angels. And so the life of celibacy now, or virginity now, is a kind of eschatological sign, a kind of anticipation of the kingdom of heaven, which is why some people are called to that vocation. Not everybody, but some people are.
833-288-EWTN. That's our toll-free number. Wide open phone lines for you at 833-288-3986. Hopefully a quick one here, Father, Dr. Andrews, before the break. Dr. Andrews, big fan, loved your book. How do you respond to Protestants who accuse Catholics of overcomplicating things? I believe it got complicated when heresy crept in. Plus, our current culture is far less pious. Do you have any book recommendations on this topic?
Oh, well, first of all, I think Catholics overcomplicate things. I would not absolve us of that charge at all. In fact, I was just having a conversation with my wife about this morning. When I look at the teaching of the Gospels, and it's just me. I mean, the doctors of the church say the same thing. And St. Paul says the same thing. The teaching of Christ cannot be completed before this radio break. So we'll hold that thought.
So we will complete it after this radio break.
After this break.
833-288-EWTN. What's stopping you from becoming a Catholic? We'd like to hear about it. 833-288-3986. It's EWTN's Call to Communion with Dr. David Anders. You know, EWTN offers the Holy Sacrifice of the Mass from Our Lady of the Angels Chapel live every morning at 8 Eastern Time. We want to help you draw closer to our Eucharistic King. Our free Mass Guide booklet, which includes both English and Latin text, will help you follow along with the Mass on EWTN and unite yourselves with Catholics worldwide. It's available at missions.ewtn.com/massguide. That's it's missions.ewtn.com/massguide. 833-288-EWTN is our toll-free number. Straight ahead, we'll talk to Angel and Steve, but first we want to finish your lovely conversation with the lovely and talented Jill Anders.
Yeah, so the question was, how do you respond to somebody that says that Catholics overcomplicate things? And I responded by saying, I think that Catholics overcomplicate things, but let me qualify. When I look at the teaching of Christ in the Gospels, it sums up, really, as Christ said it summed up, to two commands. Love God above all things, love your neighbor as yourself. On this hang all the law and the prophets. That's the interpretive key to the Christian life and all the Bible. That is exactly what the Catholic Church teaches, in fact. And so the great doctors of the church, like St. Augustine, teach that everything else in Catholic faith is a means to an end. And the end is the love of God and neighbor. It's meant to serve that end. In his confrontation with the Pharisees, Christ didn't criticize them for having rules. He criticized them for misprioritizing, for putting the rules ahead of the good of people and ahead of the honor of God. And that is not just a Pharisaical temptation. It is a human temptation. It is a perennial temptation in religious life of any kind. It's one that Catholic authorities have critiqued about Catholic life. So Francis de Sales, for example, one of my favorite examples, wrote a book called An Introduction to the Devout Life. And he, first chapter of that book, he says, what is a devout life? Is it praying the rosary, going to Mass, giving alms? And he goes through a whole list of things. He says, no, it's none of those things. Those things are all means to an end. The devout life is the love of God and neighbor. So anytime Catholics, non-Catholics, whoever, falls into the trap of thinking that, you know, because of my persnickety adherence to a whole set of arcane rules or principles or whatever have you, or my ideological camp or whatnot, and I allow those priorities to supersede the preeminent role of the love of God and neighbor, then I can be legitimately accused of complicating things. Now, you know, does that mean that religious traditions with less, say, liturgical or hierarchical accoutrements are necessarily spared that? Not at all. Not at all. You know, my father grew up in a non-Catholic denomination. I don't want to throw anybody under the bus, so I won't name it. But it's one that you can find lots of in Alabama. And he left as a young man and almost lost his faith because of his sense that the people in his congregation obsessed over minutiae that had no significance. Like, did we in fact fill out all of the attendance forms for all of the Sunday school classes? And there was the, it matters if you fill out the forms camp, and the, it doesn't matter if you fill out the forms camp, and they could fight about anything, right? And that sort of meaningless bickering over minutiae can be found in any group of people, right? And anybody can overcomplicate. But at least the Catholic faith has the virtue of saying the essential thing is the love of God and neighbor.
You know, we talk about those two commandments, and that scripture comes up with a certain amount of regularity in the cycle of readings that anybody who goes to Mass hears. And in any conversation of a Catholic nature, it's going to come up from time to time. And I think, get your opinion, I think that tends to roll off the back of many Catholics because it seems like an oversimplification. And no one, I won't say no one, most people, myself included, many times when they hear those things, just sort of write them off as being obvious and don't take stock of whether or not they're doing them.
I think that's true. And I think there's something else as well. I think that to love God and neighbor is difficult. It's hard. It's morally challenging. And we all want a shortcut. We want a technique. We want a tool that can make it happen for us. And so people gravitate to their favorite, whether it's devotional practice or liturgical style or ideological commitment, as a kind of substitute for the hard work of loving God and neighbor. And then they make the mistake of equating that, well, because I'm doing these things, I must be fulfilling all the commandments and I'm a good guy, without actually loving God and neighbor.
All right, I don't want to fill in for Tom today anymore. Angel is up first on the phones today. She is in Southwest Ohio listening to us on Sirius XM Channel 130. Angel, thank you so much for holding. You're on with Dr. Anders. Hey, Angel, are you there?
Daniel, actually.
Okay. Thank you, Daniel. We'll have some fun with that with our call screener, Mr. Gubensky, later. What can we do for you today, Daniel?
Well, during Jesus' crucifixion, the part where he's given wine to drink mixed with gall, when he tasted it, he did not drink. What exactly is gall?
A bitter narcotic that would have dulled his pain. Not the region of the world conquered by Julius Caesar. Divided into three parts.
Does that help, Daniel? Oops, I'll take that as a yes. 833-288-EWTN is our toll-free number. 833-288-3986. Plenty of lines open and plenty of time for your calls. Steve is in Oklahoma City listening on Oklahoma Catholic Radio today. Steve, you're on with Dr. David Anders.
Yes, well, thank you. So you have talked quite a bit about infused righteousness versus imputed righteousness. Do you have documentable evidence that you can give right now, and not just your interpretation of Scripture, and that I can research dated prior to 200 AD,
yeah,
proving that the early church did not teach imputed righteousness versus teaching only infused righteousness.
Absolutely. A secondary source that covers exactly that period of history that I would recommend is the book by Matthew J. Thomas entitled Paul's Works of the Law in the Perspective of Second Century Reception. It's a narrowly defined thesis. It's the interpretation of the book of Romans and Galatians as understood by second century church fathers, and whether or not the Protestant understanding of what works of the law are in the context of justification is in fact what the second century fathers thought about that. And Thomas's position, of course, is that the Protestant understanding of that passage is not what was held in the second century. Another secondary source I would recommend would be the book Justitia Dei by Alistair McGrath, who's a Protestant historian, on a history of the doctrine of justification. It's a two-volume work, and the sections on the first and second century would be relevant. Another Protestant historian, J.N.D. Kelly, and this has probably be the most helpful to you, has a book called Early Christian Doctrine that covers the teaching of early Christians on soteriology, which is salvation, and a host of other issues, divided into the apostolic fathers, and then the anti-Nicene period and the post-Nicene period. If you want to just look at primary sources, some that you might investigate would be the works of Clement of Alexandria, Justin Martyr, and Irenaeus of Lyon. Some caution, Irenaeus's works are vast and rambling, and you have to be fairly selective to find the soteriological portions. So those would be some of the most prominent writers of the second century. There are others. Tertullian of Carthage would be another one. I'm trying to think who else would come to mind that would be accessible. Any collection of the apostolic fathers, there would be people like Irenaeus of Lyon, the Shepherd of Hermas, the Didache, and other works of like provenance.
God bless you, Steve. Thanks so much for the phone call today. 833-288-EWTN. That's our toll-free number. Wide open phone lines for you at 833-288-3986. Got an anonymous email here that says, several Catholics I know have experienced catastrophic losses and grief in their lives. Their belief in God hasn't diminished, but they have each mentioned at different times that they believe their suffering is their purgatory on earth. That thought actually seems to give them some comfort. Could you please comment on their belief?
Well, I cannot comment on their potential glorification, right? I don't know what will happen to them when they die, so to speak. I think that catastrophic loss and suffering in this life can be purifying is obviously true. It doesn't have to be. It can be embittering, but it can absolutely be purifying. If you meet a deeply compassionate person who is drawn to the suffering of others like a fly to honey and seems just compelled to try to relieve that suffering, it is very likely that the person moved by such compassion is themselves someone who has suffered. It is very rare that a person raised in ease and comfort, privilege and praise has that kind of powerful empathy. It usually is itself the fruit of suffering. If you ever met anybody who was a hardened, bigoted ideologue, whose way was the highway, for whom it was his way or the highway, and everybody else was wrong and needed to, get on board and toe the line, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And such a person undergoes a radical shift in his or her generosity towards the stranger and towards those who think differently. It is usually someone who has become profoundly disillusioned themselves, often through some form of catastrophic loss. Now, you also find the person who in response to catastrophic loss, just, retreats into the bottle, the needle, the sexually immoral behavior, whatever kind of escapist response you might think of. I mean, that is also a possibility. So it's not guaranteed to be your purgatory. But if we take the attitude of Christ, Father, take this cup from me, but not my will, but thine be done, with the Blessed Virgin, be it done to thee according to thy word, and we surrender to divine providence, then yes, it can be profoundly purifying.
833-288-EWTN. That's our toll-free number. 833-288-3986. Have an email from an anonymous emailer in Corning, New York. What does Jesus mean when he says that narrow is the way that leads to salvation? And what does he mean when he says that few are strong enough to make it? How do we know that many are called but few are chosen applies to ministry and not who is saved, since he seems to say the few will make it to heaven? I was even told that even very respectable Catholic personalities have said that the way is, in fact, not narrow.
Yeah, okay, thanks. I appreciate the question. So anyone who tells you that these passages are about the sparsity of people called to professional ministry, I think has radically misread the context, because I don't think there's anything in the context of those passages that suggests this is about, say, priestly vocation. No, this is about soteriology. This is about who's going to enter the kingdom of heaven. And on the face of it, I think it's unobjectionable, just on exegetical grounds, that Jesus says it's hard to get in. It's hard to get in. And when you look at what Jesus says constitutes the grounds for admission, it's easy to see why. I mean, how many of us yearn for meekness, for genuine purity? How many of us hunger and thirst for righteousness to the extent that we're willing to give up our own unrighteous behavior? How many of us are effectively peacemakers? How many of us don't want to pray in public to be seen by men? I mean, it's not easy. It's not easy. And the story of the rich young ruler in Mark chapter 10, who comes to Christ and says, what can I do to be saved? And Christ says, well, I think you already know what to do, bud. You just keep the commandments. And he says, yeah, well, I've done that, but am I not lacking something else? Jesus says, oh, yeah, I got one last thing for you to do. Sell everything you have. Give to the poor, come and follow me. Guy doesn't do it. Why not? He had a lot of things. Didn't want to get rid of them, right? I don't want to. I don't want to get rid of stuff. I mean, I don't. It's not easy. I'm not drawn to that. So I don't think it's any mystery why Jesus says this is hard to do. It inverts a lot of our natural inclinations towards power, towards dominance, towards comfort, towards security. So I don't think it's any mystery. You're also right that there are Catholic voices, some quite prominent, some even hierarchical, who say we ought not to construe the salvation is so narrowly focused that the vast majority of the human race goes to hell. And so we balance the teaching of Christ against other emphases of the gospel and of the New Testament, like God's universal will to save. God desires that all men be saved and come to a knowledge of the truth, says St. Paul. As Christians, we pray for the salvation of everyone, especially those most in need of his mercy. That would include the gravest sinners. So how do you balance the universal will of God to save and the apparent difficulty? Well, Christ himself also seems to address that, which is that for man this is impossible, but for God all things are possible. So the position I personally take, and that and this cup of coffee are, well, worth less than a cup of coffee at Starbucks, is that I don't know. I don't need to know. So all I need to know is that the question of my own salvation is not guaranteed, that it requires me to fight, to struggle against my passions, against my sinful inclinations, to seek grace, to seek forgiveness. But it also inspires me to take a generous attitude towards my neighbor.
833-288-EWTN is our toll-free number. Straight ahead, we'll talk to Robert in Maryland, Joe in Nebraska, and Mandy in Northern Virginia. And we've still got a couple of open lines for you. 833-288-3986. It's EWTN's Call to Communion with Dr. David Anders. One of our great EWTN radio partners needs to hear from you next week. Modern Day E-Radio, with three stations serving Eugene, Portland, Vancouver, and Salem, Oregon, kicks off their spring share-a-thon on Monday. Their theme this year is Live the Peace of Christ. No matter where you live, please take a moment, prayerfully consider giving some financial support to your local Catholic radio station. 833-288-EWTN's our toll-free number. Back to the phones we go. Robert is in the great state of Maryland, listening online today. Robert, you are on with Dr. David Anders.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. My question is, about a week and a half ago on your show, you mentioned the meaning of the word cult, and you gave a great explanation of that word, and I really did appreciate that. I'm reading the book, The Holy Man of Tours. It's about Leo DuPont. And in there, multiple times, it mentions the word cult, but it uses it as the cult of the Holy Faith.
Yes,
and I'm curious if you could kind of explain that meaning of, like, in that context.
Yes, sure. So cultus in Latin just is worship, the formal rites of an act of worship, basically liturgy, that sort of thing. And so historians and theologians will talk about, say, for example, the cult of saints, meaning simply reverence or veneration paid to the saints. That's what the word means in that context. Now, this is a good example of how a word over time can radically change its meaning. Which is why etymology is never a good guide to the meaning of a word. The meaning of a word is its use. And in you know, modern secular parlance, cult usually refers to a particular kind of sociological phenomenon of a, you know, charismatically led insular religious community that exercises a kind of mind control over its members. That obviously has nothing to do with, say, the veneration of saints in Christian antiquity, which actually was quite anti-hierarchical and anything but, you know, led by a cult of personality in the other sense of the term.
Does that help, Robert?
Yes, it does. Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
You're very welcome. We appreciate the phone call. Next up is Joe in Columbus, Nebraska, listening on our great affiliate Spirit Catholic Radio. Joe, thanks for holding. You're on with Dr. Anders.
Hi, Dr. Anders.
Hi.
I was just curious what the church's official teaching is on Sunday being a day of rest.
Yeah, well, so the church does say that Sunday is a day of rest, but that doesn't mean that you can't go out and play tennis on Sunday. It doesn't mean that you can't scramble your eggs on Sunday. It doesn't even mean that you can't work a job on Sunday if it's necessary for your livelihood. What it really means is we should privilege the worship of God and sufficient rest to care for our bodies and our families. And spend time with them. But, I mean, obviously there are exceptions, and the principle of Jesus that the Sabbath was made for man, not man for the Sabbath, holds.
833-288-EWTN is our toll-free number, 833-288-3986. We head now to Northern Virginia. Mandy is a first-time caller listening on Sirius XM Channel 130. Mandy, you're on with Dr. David Anders.
Hi, I'm Dr. David Anders. This is so nice to be able to be on the air with you. I'm calling on behalf of my Orthodox friend and neighbor, and we are going back and forth on a debate about all kinds of things related to the schism, but one in particular is the dogmatic decree of the Immaculate Conception and the concept of original sin from the Orthodox perspective is taken. His explanation is that there is just consequences of sin, but that we're not left with the guilt of original sin based on the Catholic perspective. So I'm calling to better understand the Immaculate Conception dogma and why, in his argument, Thomas Aquinas was against it.
Yeah, thank you so much. I appreciate the question. So, lots of things to discuss here. Original sin, Orthodox and Catholic perspectives, the Blessed Virgin, the Immaculate Conception, and St. Thomas Aquinas. Let's knock them out one at a time. Let's start with Aquinas. It is often asserted that Aquinas denied the dogma of the Immaculate Conception. Well, Aquinas denied a version of the doctrine of the Immaculate Conception that was circling around in the 13th century It's not exactly the dogma that was ultimately proclaimed by the church. Furthermore, Aquinas absolutely did believe that Mary was sanctified before her birth and lived an actually sinless life. So there's very little daylight between what Aquinas actually believed and what the church finally declared, except the qualification that Mary was sanctified from the moment of her conception. That is precisely what the church affirms. Aquinas didn't affirm that, but he did affirm her sanctification before birth and her actual sinlessness, that she never committed an actual sin. And the version of the Immaculate Conception that he rejected was not, in fact, the one ever dogmatically affirmed by the church. So you have to be very careful when you start trying to set Thomas up as an opponent of this doctrine. It's kind of apples and oranges. Doesn't really apply. A couple other points. There are a lot of reasons, well, at least two, three perhaps, that Orthodox theologians object to the doctrine of the Immaculate Conception. But one of them is that how can you have a doctrine of Mary cleansed from original sin if you don't have a doctrine of original sin? And so it kind of goes without saying, if you don't believe in original sin, then you don't know need in being cleansed from it. So you wouldn't have a doctrine of the Immaculate Conception. Bracket for a second the question of original sin, and let's just ask your Orthodox friends, do you in fact think that Mary ever sinned? Obviously not. They don't think Mary ever sinned, ever. They think she was the all-holy, all-pure one, and the mother of God, right? So it's not really a debate about Mary's moral status. It's more a debate about how to conceptualize that metaphysically. What happened from the divine side to bring that about? Another objection that the Orthodox will sometimes bring is in Orthodox soteriology, that is to say the doctrine of salvation, they lay a heavy emphasis upon synergy, the idea that the work of the salvation of the soul is a collaboration between the grace of God and the will of man. Now, from a Catholic point of view, we agree with that. We agree that salvation is synergistic, it's not monergistic. But we do also think that the ability to cooperate with grace is itself a work of grace, right? Finally, the Orthodox objection to the doctrine of original sin on the grounds that we do not personally inherit the guilt of Adam is in fact the Catholic position. That is what Catholics hold. If you read the Catechism of the Catholic Church on original sin, the Catechism says that original sin is not actual sin. It is sin by analogy and does not involve personal culpability for the sin of Adam. It is true there have been individual Catholic thinkers down through the centuries that did not hold that view, that did take personal culpability as implied in the doctrine of original sin, and that absolutely is the position of Calvinism. So in the Protestant tradition, they took a very hardline original sin and maintained that even infants were personally deserving of eternal damnation because of the inherited sin of Adam. Catholics do not believe that. They do not believe that. The reason that the Catholics developed a doctrine of limbo, which is not dogma, it's just a theological opinion, was precisely to eliminate the possibility of infants suffering for sins that they did not commit. Right. So it's just never been the official dogma of the church that infants or anybody else personally inherit the guilt of Adam. So I think there's a lot less daylight between the Orthodox position and the Catholic position than they would like. Now, the final thing I would say about this is that, you know, I have a kind of a distant acquaintance who was a theology professor, American, but he was a theology professor in an Orthodox seminary in Albania. He's actually the friend of a friend of mine. And he once remarked, you know, a lot of my co-religionists in Albania just don't know why they hate Catholics so much. And like, the given was, oh, we all know we're supposed to hate Catholics, but now we have to go learn why we have to hate Catholics, right? That there's a lot of historic animosity between the traditions. And when I have engaged Orthodox apologetical literature, I'm always amazed by the way that, especially popular Orthodox literature, the way the Catholic position is caricatured. And I'll give you an example. I read a book on the atonement by the very popular Orthodox writer, what is her name? Frederica Matthews Green. I think that's her name. Good writer. I enjoyed her book enormously. It was a book on the atonement. And half the book was what she thinks the atonement is, and half the book was why she thinks the Catholics are wrong. And I read the book, and I thought, I don't know any Catholic believes the position that you just repudiated, and I actually agree with everything you said about the atonement, right? So it's not landing with me. Your critique isn't landing with me because I don't find myself falling into the position that you're critiquing. And there, you know, there's some confusion, I think, in Orthodox apologetics about the fact that not all Catholics are medieval Latins, right? That there, you know, there are theological schools of thought, some more prominent in the West, some more prominent in the East. But that doesn't mean that the Catholic position is identifiable with some particular theological school at some time, right? The Catholic Church includes Eastern Catholic Christians throughout the millennia who hold theological positions almost indistinguishable from the Orthodox. They're also part of the Catholic family, right? So I think sometimes these are unfair stereotypes and caricatures of the Catholic tradition.
Next up for us is the Republic of Texas. Jason is listening on Sirius XM Channel 130 today. Jason, thanks so much for holding. You're on with Dr. Anders.
Good afternoon, Dr. Anders. I'm a Christian Scientist from Houston. My question is regarding secrecy in the Vatican, specifically the relationship between Pope Sixtus and Michelangelo and also Leonardo da Vinci. I think there's a great deal of distrust when I'm an art historian myself, and I know that one of the self-portraits of da Vinci could not have been done by hand. He had to have been using a camera obscura, and I was just wondering why there is this cult of secrecy. And I won't get into the popular culture stuff.
Okay,
but,
yeah.
Thanks.
I really appreciate the question. So you mentioned that you're an art historian. I am not. I'm not an art historian. I'm a historian of dogma and theology. So I must say that I'm way out of my depth in answering questions about the relationship of church to art. You probably know more about the subject than I do. You know, the first thing that strikes me when someone says the Vatican is holding a secret is, oh yeah, what secret is that, right? If it's a secret, it hasn't been revealed. If you know about it, it's not secret, right? So I'm you know, a little bit perplexed by that part of the question. I don't know that I grant the premise of the question. Now, the Vatican has all kinds of information that it's not going to release. Right, I have all kinds of for information I'm not going to release. You can't have my social security number, right, or my bank account number, or the names of my children, or where they are right now. I mean, there's like tons of things I'm not going to tell you. Yes, I'm very secretive about them. I think that's reasonable. I think the church sometimes has good reason not to say everything that it knows in every question. Sometimes it probably has lousy reasons. So, for example, if a bishop suppresses the name of a priest known to be sexually abusive, well, shame on that bishop. Terrible thing. I think the motive why someone would do that is fairly obvious, but also reprehensible. So let's assume, for the sake of argument, the church has some secrets it should keep and some that it shouldn't. Let's say that it keeps some secrets for nefarious reasons, because it's trying to cover its tracks or cover up, you know, misdeeds. Okay, well, shame on the church hierarchy if they do that. I'm sure they have. I'm sure they will again, right? Because they're human beings. The church is a powerful institution. So I guess more to the point, how do I as a lay Catholic feel about that? I think my pastors are human beings. I don't worship them. I don't regard them as infallible, except in very, very, very rare circumstances. I think they ought to be held accountable for bad actions, right? And when they don't, I mean, saints and prophets and critics throughout the century, within and without the church, have rightly critiqued them. That's how I feel. Don't disagree with you about that at all.
833-288-EWTN is our toll-free number. Mother Angelica answering the call great program. We have gone to great lengths to pull out some of the best phone calls Mother Angelica received on her live shows down through the years. It's available to you Sunday at 2 p.m. and then again at 8 p.m. Eastern time. And it features not only those calls from Mother Angelica, but some commentary from Father Joseph Mary Wolfe and Doug Keck. Just a terrific program. Check it out if you get the opportunity. Mother Angelica answering the call Sunday at 2 and 8 p.m. Eastern right here on EWTN Radio. You know, David, as you were finishing up the answer to that question, it reminded me recently I saw a video clip of a comedian who was asking a member of the audience who had said they had left the Catholic Church, and he asked them, why did you leave the Catholic Church? And he said, because of the sex abuse scandal. And the comedian said, oh, I see. So are you ready to leave America? The logic gets lost sometimes, right, when we're articulating our positions on these things. Isabel is up next in the great state of New Jersey, listening on Domestic Church Media. Isabel, you're on with Dr. Anders.
Hello, good afternoon, Dr. Anders. I just have a quick question because I'm arguing with some friends and family members that the Pope visited Africa and he went to a mosque to pray. Isn't that against the, you know, first commandment?
Yeah, thank you very much. I appreciate the question. So Catholics and Muslims definitely do not hold the same beliefs about God, and they do not hold the same beliefs about what God requires of us. I think that's patently obvious. And the Pope does not believe the Quran. The Pope does not believe that God is the way that the Muslims say he is. But I can say this about Muslims. They're not big on idolatry. They're not big on idolatry. In fact, they're pretty stark opponents of idolatry. And so I do think there is a difference between the Pope praying to God in a mosque and, say, venerating a pagan idol. I think those would be very different kinds of things. I don't think that the Pope's actions, at least I don't read it this way, I don't think the Pope's actions imply his belief in Muslim doctrine, but rather a recognition that there is at least a kind of family resemblance between Islam and Christianity based on their belief in the one God and the Abrahamic tradition. And the Second Vatican Council affirms, as ordinary magisterial teaching of the Church, that outside of the Catholic Church there can be salvation, not because of the particular doctrines of other religions, but in spite of them, because of the commonalities that we share, God's grace can extend beyond the formal boundaries of Catholicism. We should recognize that and work for promoting peace between peoples. Now, if you know something about the contemporary history of Islam and Christianity in Western Africa, you know that it has been quite contentious and violent, and that Nigeria in particular is a place where intense persecution of Christians is taking place, and a lot of that is, you know, between Islam and Christianity. And I think from the Pope's perspective, it probably wouldn't serve the interests of world peace and interreligious cooperation for him to go to Africa and make a big stink about all the things he doesn't like about Islam. Right, I mean, he's trying to build commonality and peace between two traditions that are having a really hard time there right now, and so he judges that that interreligious dialogue and prayer is a more effective path to peace than finger wagging. That's the way I read him.
We received a text from Bobby, and he says, "Can you explain what Divine Mercy Sunday is, how long its graces last, and whether the following steps means a person goes straight to heaven? And also, can someone accumulate plenary indulgences by receiving them every year, and do they help at the end of your life?"
So let me just jump right to the end of the question, which is about the nature of the plenary of indulgence. Can you stack plenary indulgences? Can you acquire a ton of them, this sort of thing? So whether it's the indulgence attached to the Divine Mercy devotion, whether it's praying the rosary, whether it's a pilgrimage, whether it's reading the Bible for 30 minutes, or all these other things that you can do in the church to obtain an indulgence, and have at them. I mean, you know, knock yourself out. That's great. I do too. I mean, I get these things. My favorite indulgence I ever got was during the Year of Faith. Pope Benedict said, "Grant a plenary indulgence to anyone that goes and prays in the place of their baptism." I was baptized at Briarwood Presbyterian Church on Highway 280 in Birmingham, Alabama, sometime in the early 1970s. And that church has since ceased to be the location of a Presbyterian church. It's become an independent Bible church. Let me tell you something. Independent Bible churches and Catholics have very different concepts of what constitutes sacred space, right? At least in my experience in the South, the closest thing to a sacred space in independent Bible church land would be a kind of outdoor mountaintop chapel at a summer camp with a 20-something camp counselor and a 12-string guitar singing Kumbaya, right? That's sacred space for them, not the sanctuary, which is usually filled with all kinds of things that would not be found in the Catholic Church and vice versa. So the idea of somebody coming on a weekday and kneeling where they're, you know, in a pew where there are no kneelers and saying a private prayer surrounded by, you know, like balloon animals from the Sunday school class or whatever is just incongruous. Yet I did that. And somebody's like, what are you doing here? What a day that was. That was a fun indulgence. But anyway, the theology of the thing. You know, we have to have no attachment to sin, first of all. Good luck being a good judge of that in your own case, right? So we do these things because the church has this power to distribute the merits of the saints on our behalf. You know, with extraordinary liberality, we submit ourselves to that regime. We trust in the mercy of God. But none of that is a pass that guarantees our entrance to heaven if we don't die with the love of God and neighbor in our hearts, right? So the ethical demands of the gospel are not obviated by acquiring a plenary indulgence. We should still throw ourselves on the mercy of God and the intercession of the church, believing that those things are efficacious, but leave the mathematics of the thing, I think, up ultimately to the judgment of God.
We head now to Bay St. Louis, Mississippi. Nathan is listening on Catholic Community Media today. Nathan, you're on with Dr. Anders.
Good afternoon. I have a question about, does the Bible ever talk about space and like Mars, Venus, Pluto, like that?
Yeah, thank you. I really appreciate the question. So, to the best of my knowledge, and I've read the whole Bible, and I'm trying to remember if there's any passage that specifically names the astral orbs in our solar system. I don't think there's any passage that goes into that kind of detail. They do talk about the stars, right? They do talk about the atmosphere. They talk about the solar system in a general sense. But the most of that kind of language in sacred scripture presumes ancient cosmology. And the scripture writers are not generally concerned with the physical phenomenon so much as they are with the moral or spiritual significance of, say, the act of creation and our placement within it. And so, you know, from the Catholic Church's point of view, those incidental details of ancient cosmology are not what's binding upon the Catholic conscience. So, for example, I'm not obligated to believe that there's a physical firmament, you know, hanging over the stratosphere. That was obviously a belief in ancient Canaan. Biblical writers use those kinds of terminology to describe, you know, the upper atmosphere, because that's what's current in the day. But that's not what's normative for me as a Catholic.
And we had another text from an anonymous texter listening on the EWTN app. I abstain from meat on Fridays all year long, but I'm not sure about Fridays during the Easter season. Please advise.
Yeah, thanks. I really appreciate the question. So, you know, fasting as a discipline, a habitual discipline, not just a liturgical fast, but a habitual discipline, we would engage in because we're doing it to counteract, you know, a particular passion. We're trying to sort of get a control of ourselves, be more virtuous and so forth. And so if, for example, if gluttony is a temptation for you, the discipline of fasting once a week could be a helpful remedy in that. Now, you know, all the church fathers and the doctors warn, anytime something like that becomes too routine, you can have the danger of falling into the pharisaical temptation of, I thank thee, God, that I'm not like this guy at the pizza joint over here, and I fast every Friday, look how great I am. As soon as we've fallen into that, then we're not benefiting from the practice at all. So, you know, it's not spiritual magic. It's not a sort of slot machine with God where, you know, the number of times I fast ups my odds of getting some sort of divine grace. You don't think of it that way. This is just a spiritual discipline you're engaging in to help you get control of your passions and live a holier life. The second it becomes sort of formulaic and mechanical and you begin to, you know, count it off like it's a magic spell, then you're not doing it for the right motives.
Now, all that being said, can I give you the letter of the law?
Sure.
So the letter of the law would be that we as Catholics are called to abstain from meat on Fridays, all Fridays during the year, with the exception of solemnities that fall on Friday. Of course, the Friday of the Octave of Easter would be one such date.
Right.
The other Fridays of the Easter season would not be that. But what Holy Mother Church requires of us is to abstain from meat on Fridays. If you choose not to, you can substitute another penance.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right.
Jack and Cynthia, I'm so sorry we are flat out of time today, but we invite you to call in on another day of EWTN's Call to Communion. Thanks for another great week of Call to Communion. We'll be back at it again on Monday with a brand spanking new episode for you. On behalf of our host, Dr. David Anders, producer Pedro Quiles, our call screener Matt Gubensky, and social media maven Mr. Rich Jesse, I'm Jack Williams sitting in again for Tom Price today. Thanks so much for tuning in. Back at it Monday. Until then, God bless.